You've probably heard that Donald Trump believes he has immunity from what Jack Smith has accused him of. It's an interesting argument which Trump is making, and the Supreme Court will be hearing it very soon. Tonight, we're going to address this argument. Daniel R. Street, a veteran trial lawyer, is here to share his immensely valuable insight on this episode of Newsite. I am your host, Joseph Cotto. Daniel, thank you very much for being here.
Hey, I'm glad to be here, and thank you for having me on again.
Very glad to feature you. I obviously want as many people as possible to hear your very keen legal insight, and there will be quite a bit of opportunity to share that this evening. Now, obviously, Trump's argument is interesting. Some would call it a novel argument, but before we get into that, please tell folks who you are, what you do, and why it's relevant to the discussion.
Well, thank you. So I'm Daniel R. Street. I'm an attorney. I have 27 and a half years experience in civil practice here in Louisiana. I'm an author. I've written four books. I have a three-book series about fake news exposed about Trump, where I attack and dismantle various different media propaganda pieces and hit pieces on Donald Trump and his administration. I have another book more recently that's about fake news that covers a wide variety of subjects, including a couple of issues, fake news attacks on Governor DeSantis in Florida, covers immigration, COVID misinformation, and other things. And also I have a Substack. My Substack, I write about fake news and lawfare and the attacks of the left that the left are making all over the country on Republicans and on President Trump and on fake news. So That's what I'm doing. That's who I am. You can find everything I'm doing at my website, which is DanielRStreet.com.
Excellent. Just had to have you share that information. I mean, obviously, talking about anything to do with Trump and the court system is going to be wading into the weeds, and the weeds grow taller every week. But it's something that has to be done, obviously, because this is of massive, massive public importance. So anyway, looking at the whole ecosystem of his immunity argument, since the inception of the United States presidency in 1789 until 2023, no former or current president had faced criminal charges for their official acts. This longstanding tradition held for a significant reason: to preserve the functionality of the presidency and its essential independence. Criminal prosecution of a president for actions taken while in office would not only impede the president's decision-making process, but also open the door to potential abuse, manipulation, and political vendettas. The threat of prosecution would loom over every future president, transforming sensitive decisions into tools for political leverage and eroding the authority of the presidency itself. In the case of President Trump's indictment in 2023, the charges stem from actions taken during his tenure as president, raising fundamental questions about the extent of a former president's immunity from criminal prosecution. The indictment alleged various official acts, including public statements, communications with government officials, and interactions with state and congressional representatives related to the 2020 federal election. President Trump asserted immunity from prosecution, invoking the principles of executive power and separation of powers enshrined in the Constitution. Central to the argument for presidential immunity is the executive vesting clause and the principle of separation of powers. From the landmark Marbury v. Madison case in 1803 to Nixon v. Fitzgerald in 1982, the Supreme Court consistently upheld the idea that a president's official acts are beyond the reach of judicial review. The impeachment judgment clause further reinforces this understanding by stipulating that only a president convicted by the Senate following impeachment can face criminal prosecution. This constitutional framework reflects the founders' intent to balance accountability with the protection of the presidency from politically motivated attacks. Now, there's quite a bit more I will get into, but Daniel, just starting out, anything to say thus far?
Well, first, let me observe. I believe that's probably one of the most succinct and accurate recitations of the situation of the case before the court and what the law is and ought to be that I've heard thus far. And that includes the ones that I've stated. So that was a brilliant colloquy, in my opinion.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Do you believe, that the perspective set forth is something that the justices, the Supreme Court justices, will find worthwhile?
Absolutely, without a doubt. Listen, the United States Supreme Court is going to find that a president has immunity for his official acts, immunity from criminal prosecution in the absence of impeachment, in my opinion. And the reason for that is because a similar immunity has been granted to every other branch of government. So under our Constitution, there are three branches of government. There's the executive branch, which is the presidency and the federal executive offices. There's the judiciary branch or the judicial branch, and there's the legislative branch. The legislative branch is Congress, you know, the United States House and the United States Senate. And the judicial branch includes all of the judges that exercise Article III judges that exercise judicial power. Everybody else has immunity for official acts, immunity from criminal prosecution for official acts. Everybody else. So the notion that the United States Supreme Court ruled that the president of the United States does not enjoy a similar immunity is, in my view, just nonsense. It's ridiculous. The question's going to be, and this will something we can delve into a little bit later or now if you choose, is were these official acts or not? And that's a separate question. So I believe that what we'll wind up with is the Supreme Court recognizing the president's immunity for his official acts and specifically immunity from criminal prosecution for his official acts. And then we'll have a remand of the case back to district court for determination as to whether or not the acts charged were official acts or not.
Before we go any further, I just have to say that obviously some folks, well, actually most legal quote-unquote scholars and quote-unquote experts believe that the Supreme Court would not take this up, that it would be sent back to Chumkan after the after a panel, not the full court, but a panel of the D.C. Court of Appeals ruled against Trump unanimously. But the Supreme Court did decide to take this up, which says to me that there is definitely some interest on the court in resolving the question, which are posed by Trump's suit. And I don't think Jack Smith really anticipated that the Supreme Court would take this up. And it is definitely worth mentioning that many of the same people who say the Supreme Court is going to rule against Trump, blah, 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 they're the same ones who said that, you know, the Supreme Court wouldn't take up the case to begin with. Some of them didn't even think the appellate court would give Trump a hearing. It was really interesting to see these people be so wrong about so many things. And some of these folks are the same ones who were adamant that Trump would be prevented from running because the Supreme Court would uphold the Colorado Supreme Court's banishment of Trump from the ballot. So it's interesting to see how many people have been wrong here. They don't seem to have been shaken in their confidence, which is quite interesting. But you know, maybe that's something for a psychologist to address very well. But it's interesting stuff, put mildly. Anything to say about these people and their track record, Dan?
Yes. Well, look, there were a host of legal prognosticators, particularly liberals and the left and never Trumpers, who went all over the airwaves for months claiming that the 14th Amendment, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment would disqualify President Trump from running for office. Now, that was just ludicrous. And when all of that first popped up a year and a half ago, I didn't think it would go anywhere. I certainly didn't think they would get the Colorado Supreme, get any Supreme Court to rule in favor of it because it was just lunacy. But once the Colorado opinion came down, these pundits went all over the place talking, oh, Trump's done, he's through, he's finished, and the Supreme Court's going to rule this, and they're going to rule that. And they were all wrong. And, you know, but they're, as you mentioned, they are undeterred by having been wrong, and wrong repeatedly, by the way, wrong about whether a case is going, the cases would get to trial, wrong about what's going to happen with them, wrong about the Colorado case, wrong about whether the Supreme Court would grant writ in this case. Those same people are making the same incorrect prognostications. And I think it basically boils down to they've made legal commentating almost the same as weather forecasting. You know, it's the only people who can be consistently, persistently, endlessly wrong and they never get fired are weather forecasters. And now liberal legal commentators.
It's amazing. There has really been the rise of a cottage industry on cable news and even on social media, wherein people who are on the left throw out hot takes about the law and how it's going to be applied. And people eat this stuff up. And even if these so-called bright lights are wrong, people continue eating their stuff up. You could determine what the stuff is. But the fact of the matter is that these people never face any sort of professional consequence for being wrong. So it's my opinion that they will continue to be wrong in increasingly bizarre ways because of the interest and money it generates. Although for these people, I think it's a mistake to say that money is their primary motivator. If money is their primary motivator, they would be, you know, working at a white shoe firm in D.C. or in New York or maybe San Francisco, L.A., Miami. But instead, they are doing very public-facing work. So I think they thrive on the attention more than anything else. And for certain, they get the attention and they keep themselves relevant to the sizable base of people which believes that Donald Trump is inherently evil.
Yeah, well, I think that what we're dealing with, or what we're seeing with respect to a lot of the punditry, is that a lot of the legal experts that are brought on to ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, they're brought on for confirmation bias. And so what they're doing is telling the fake news media what they want to hear, you know, and some of them are more adamant about it. You know, Professor Lawrence Tribe, who's really just beclowned himself in the era of Trump being wrong and spreading misinformation just time and time again. I got a chapter in one of my books about fake news, about some of his nonsense. That's what he's done to himself. And this was a very well-respected man previously, you know. So look, anybody who's going to come in and offer an opinion on legal matters and is reading what I like to call tea leaves, they're going to be wrong sometimes. That includes me and you know, somebody that's Alan Dershowitz or Jonathan Turley or, you know, renowned professors and legal minds. They're going to be wrong sometimes. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But the problem we have here is they're just persistently wrong. And it's because they're not trying to be accurate in many cases, you know. So that gives the American people, unfortunately, misinformation in one context or another about very important legal matters. And it's really sad, frankly. It's unfortunate, but it's sad. And there are a number of different parts of our culture, different aspects, different groups that have lost a lot of credibility of late. And one is, you know, the medical establishment over the COVID misinformation. But another are courts and lawyers in the age of Trump lawfare. So I think we all have an obligation to try to be accurate and to give people the best information that we can and the best opinion that we can, with the recognition that sometimes we'll be wrong, but not to color it up because that's what everybody wants to hear.
One big problem, and I brought this up with you in private communication, is that there is this clique of people who are very public figures, who are lawyers and who issue their legal takes on various matters, not just pertaining to Trump, but towards the non-left moreover. And these takes get a hell of a lot of airtime or, you know, clicks in the digital age. And as a result, there is a very distorted view among the general public as to what the law entails and how the law is likely to be applied in any given scenario. So this really is bad. It does the non-left a tremendous disservice because you have the court of public opinion being colored by people who are treated as if they are authorities on the court of law. And even when they're wrong, public opinion among a good deal of people has already shifted in a way that is not only counterproductive to basically blind justice, but it's something which winds up being a PR issue for the GOP, for, you could say, conservatives, for non-lefties generally. There has been a focus on the left of getting people out there who will issue very, very ideologically pleasing opinions. And this, I believe, is done to not influence how a judge will think or how a jury will think, even though if this happens, it's about their bonus points. But it's principally to influence how the public thinks. And the non-left really does not have much of anything to answer this. I guess Alan Dershowitz would be the best example, but he is a liberal himself, a liberal Democrat, just not a leftist in terms of where where so-called progressivism has gone. So it's really a dreadful state of affairs.
You know, it is, and if somebody could accuse me, all street, you go on all these conservative shows and you tell people what they want to hear, but I'm not here to tell you. I tell people what I believe to be true and what the law is, and when I make a prognostication, I tell everybody this is my opinion, you know. And sometimes I can tell you for certain that my opinion are things that people most assuredly do not want to hear. And so, for instance, as this case made its way up, told everybody the district court is going to rule against President Trump on presidential immunity. You can mark it down. I said the D.C. Circuit was going to rule against him as well. They went even further than I anticipated they would with all the gamesmanship with the mandate and everything. And we can talk about that. But that's not what anybody wanted to hear, I can assure you. You know, so I'm just calling balls and strikes here, and that's what people need to do. And when we're not 100% on something, we need to tell people. There's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, I saw somebody a couple of weeks ago, I saw a prognosticator complaining about someone who had appeared on a show previously who had a different opinion. And the guy says, well, this guy's not he doesn't have any expertise in presidential immunity. And so, well, guess what? Neither does anybody else, because no court has ever considered presidential criminal immunity in the history of this country. So no one's an expert on presidential immunity except for the people who've read up on what there is to read about it. So, you know, it's not the same as saying, you know, this guy's an expert on federal sentencing guidelines, or this guy's an expert on X or Y. This is something that no one has any more expertise than anyone else with a law degree. And so that in and of itself, as you might imagine, can lead to a wide variety of opinions on what the court might do or will do and what the law is or ought to be.
It's unfortunate, but you can basically guess how a lot of judges are going to rule on the basis of which president appointed them, or if they're elected, obviously, which party they're a member of, or if they're quote-unquote nonpartisan, then which area they come from, because that would be a pretty good determinant of their partisan leanings. But this definitely is where things stand, and it's a terrible state of affairs.
Well, in fact, I can do you one better. You can determine in many instances how a judge or judges are going to rule on something based on who is at issue or what is at issue in the case. So, for instance, I said a moment ago that when this whole issue came up about presidential immunity, that the district court in D.C., the district judge was going to rule against President Trump, and that the D.C. Circuit, no matter who the panel, no matter what the three-judge panel consisted of, they're going to rule against President Trump and presidential immunity. I can also guarantee you that if this was a prosecution of former President Barack Obama for the drone strike on an American citizen in Yemen, if he was being charged under federal law for that drone strike, that all of those judges I just mentioned, the district judge and the three judges on the D.C. Circuit, would have ruled just the opposite of what they ruled in this case. So a lot of times when you get Trump involved, it's the courts, the judges kind of turn the law on its head and they just reach whatever decision is going to stick it to President Trump. And that's what I think went on here. And certainly the extent to which the D.C. Circuit went to was just blatantly an effort to stick it to President Trump.
Absolutely. Why do you suppose that a lot of federal judges are so adamant in their opposition to Trump? There is even the senior status judge who came out and spoke against Trump the other day, which is unprecedented as far as I know. So why do you think a lot of judges have this extreme antipathy for Trump?
Well, particularly with the D.C. judges is, you know, a lot of them are political animals. And if you look, it's part of the breakdown. I've been talking about this for a while, is that the federal judiciary, let me state this, there are a lot of good federal judges. There are a lot of conservative. There are a lot of honest. There's a lot of good liberal federal judges and that are trying to do the right thing and trying to reach a just result and apply the facts to the law and call balls and strikes like they're supposed to. But there's also a lot of highly and overly political federal judges, and not just Democrats. So these, I call it the Republican, the globalist bourgeois Republican uniparty types, and they permeate the federal bench because it's kind of the Bush-Cheney legacy, you know, and these people don't like anything that they attack, anything that challenges the narrative, that challenges the powers that be in the status quo. And President Trump challenges the status quo. And so these people are, these are status quo people. And that's what they want an end to Trump, and they don't care how it happens. And there's too much of that. And the reason for that is there's so many people that are on the federal bench are political. And look at Burl Howell, a D.C. district judge who was literally a political activist. What do you think is going to happen if you take a lifelong Democrat political activist and put that person on the federal bench? You're going to get a liberal Democrat political activist wearing a robe. And so that this has happened all over the country for years because the United States Senate has, in my opinion, abdicated its responsibility to give advice and consent. They have to approve the judges, and they just rubber stamping people that they should not rubber stamp. And that's what you wind up with are too many judges that are politics. They're into politics instead of being statesmanlike and judicious.
Now, before I get back to my monologue, there is the question of how Republicans should deal with this, because some people say, well, the Democrats have their hack judges, so the Republicans should try to get through as many of their own hack judges. The Republicans have traditionally tried to appoint judges that will be faithful to an originalist interpretation of the Constitution. And that can, I mean, you could generally predict how it will go for Republicans when they're in the courtroom of the GOP-appointed judge, because the judge would have a certain interpretation of the law that aligns with the interpretation of the law brought forth by whichever Republican has come before the court. But a lot of Republicans say, you know, the Democrats go further than this. It's not just about agreement about the law. It's about Democratic judges saying, we want the law to be this for the sake of our party, and we're going to make it that. And so a lot of Republicans say that the GOP method of having statesman-like jurists is no longer suiting the interests of the party. So it's good to have sort of hack judges who will reinterpret the law in a way that benefits the party line. More and more Republicans want to see this. Obviously, something that I find a bit unnerving. What do you think about this perspective, Daniel?
Well, I understand completely why people would have that point of view and push that policy agenda. I don't think long term that's the answer. you know, people have to remember that judicial appointments are lifetime appointments. And so once a judge gets on the bench, it is a federal bench, it's incredibly difficult to remove him or her. So I would like to see the United States Senate, and let's go back. I would like to see presidents make a Democrat or Republican make a more concerted effort to appoint respectable, responsible legal practitioners to the bench. And look, there are plenty of legitimate, thoughtful, conscientious, liberal lawyers that can be made judges. There are plenty of conscientious Republican conservative lawyers that could be made judges. And that's what we need to focus on doing. And the U.S. Senate needs to make sure that those are the kind of people that are being confirmed. And that would go a long way towards solving the problem.
Well, perhaps if Trump wins, he would consider appointing you to the federal bench in Louisiana. I think it'd be a wonderful idea. He could hardly do any better. Although whether or not you'd want the job is another story.
Well, I appreciate that, and thank you kindly for the endorsement. But no, you couldn't make me a federal judge for all the tea in China. I would not want to do that job. Not that it's a great judge's job insofar as being a judge is concerned. I just have zero interest in being a judge.
I don't blame you. It's definitely not for everyone. Obviously, I'm not a lawyer, but if I were, it probably would not be for me. It's an interesting job, but a very demanding one. In this day and age, judges are increasingly viewed as politicians, and in many cases they are if they're elected, but they're increasingly viewed as partisan operators, I should say. So that definitely brings with it a great deal of issues. I'll just leave that there. Now, getting back to my monologue, the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Constitution has consistently upheld the notion of presidential immunity. In Marbury v. Madison, Chief Justice John Marshall established the precedent that the judiciary cannot scrutinize the president's official acts, a doctrine reaffirmed over two centuries in landmark cases. Nixon v. Fitzgerald cemented the idea that a former president cannot be held personally liable for actions within the outer perimeter of official responsibility. These legal precedents underscore the significance of presidential immunity as a bulwark against unwarranted legal challenges that could undermine the functioning of the executive branch. Presidential immunity not only shields the president from legal jeopardy, but also ensures the effective functioning of the executive branch. The prospect of criminal prosecution would inhibit bold decision-making and undermine the president's ability to fulfill their duties. As noted in Morrison v. Olson, unchecked prosecution would weaken the presidency, diminishing its strength, authority, and decisiveness. Such vulnerability to legal challenges would subject every future president to the constant threat of manipulation and harassment, impairing their ability to govern effectively. The office of the president demands a degree of autonomy to execute its constitutional duties effectively. A president must be able to make decisions without fear of personal repercussions, ensuring that the interests of the nation take precedence over personal concerns. The imposition of criminal liability for official acts would not only hinder the president's ability to carry out their duties, but also undermine the separation of powers by subjecting the executive branch to undue judicial scrutiny. Thus, presidential immunity serves as a vital safeguard against encroachments on executive authority and preserves the balance of power envisioned by the framers of the Constitution. Now, obviously, a lot of people would not like at all what I just said, but it is what I truly believe. It's based upon history as I understand it. Daniel, anything to say about my point of view?
Sure. I can tell you that you're probably going to read something very, very similar to what you just recited when the Supreme Court's decision on this case comes down, because that's what they're going to rule, in my opinion. And the reason for that is because everything you said is true. And that is, we can't have prosecutors waiting in the wings to pounce on the president whenever he makes a decision that turns out, you know, to be controversial, or that the results of that decision are not what we wanted. And when I tell you that happens all the time, and we're talking about decisions that implicate Americans' national security, that implicate policy, foreign policy, domestic policy, immigration policy, every kind of decision that you can imagine. How about crime and punishment issues? So everything, what the American people need to understand is if what is being done to Trump is allowed to move forward and there is no presidential immunity, and that's essentially what the court have to rule. So if the United States Supreme Court rules the same way the D.C. Circuit did, and says, oh, President Trump's just a normal guy after his term ends, and he can be prosecuted like anybody else for anything he did, then any future Republican president in particular, but really any future president that gets sideways with the establishment is going to be behind the eight ball and prosecuted and harassed and not able to do his job. This is literally a question that will determine the efficacy of the office of the presidency for the future of this country. And I just don't believe that the United States Supreme Court, under these circumstances, would reach any other conclusion.
If it did, I mean, a president from either party should be very, very nervous because there's no telling what would happen to them after they leave office. You have a state prosecutor such as Fannie Willis bringing a charge, although the situation with her has been sidetracked, to say the absolute least. And obviously, I mean, if Trump is found to have immunity by the Supreme Court, at least for his official duties, determining those official duties would probably, as you mentioned, go back to the district court. It's not hard to figure out what Shucan would do. She'd apply the most restrictive standard possible for Donald Trump. And not for Barack Obama, I'm sure, who she volunteered to campaign for, by the way. Shocker. But looking at other cases, I mean, the Jack Smith case in Florida, which is already now very much in question, that would certainly be negatively impacted by a ruling favorable to Trump, obviously by the Supreme Court. And then there is the Fannie Willis case, which is in a difficult spot, to say the least. That also would be upended by a positive ruling for Trump at the Supreme Court. So really all the cases against it, except for the one in New York, hinge upon this matter before the Supreme Court.
You're right. And, to a lesser extent, obviously the D.C. case against President Trump, I'm talking about the criminal prosecution, involves all of the conduct for which President Trump was charged. He was charged. He was still president whenever that conduct and those actions or inactions took place. So that case is totally dependent on the Supreme Court's interpretation of presidential immunity. And much the same could be said for the Georgia case, because it was also the Fulton County DA's case involves actions that Donald J. Trump was involved in while he was president. The Florida case involves some decisions that were made while he was president, but also involve activities and actions and conduct that occurred after he was president and after any presidential immunity would no longer apply to his actual activities. So that case would be implicated or impacted by the Supreme Court's decision, but not necessarily gutted, you know. So the prosecution in New York by the Manhattan DA, there was an effort by the Trump legal team to raise presidential immunity. It was done belatedly, meaning late. I don't think it's really implicated in the Manhattan case.
Yeah, the Manhattan case is interesting because that's obviously coming, or it's scheduled to go to court this month. Who knows if it actually will? That's, always an interesting question. I will just ask briefly about that, Dan, before we get back to the all-important immunity matter. Do you think that there is a chance, any serious chance, that the Trump Manhattan case does not go to trial when it's scheduled for, which is around the same time that the Supreme Court will be hearing Donald Trump's immunity argument?
Yeah, I have a theory, and let me say to your audience, I could be wrong, okay? I could be wrong, so take it with a grain of salt. But I don't think that case is going to go to trial on April 15th. We'll find out soon enough. But the reason for that is it's number one, the polling shows us that that's the case that independents in particular. And remember, if the independents are going to determine who the president is, they pretty much always do. It's a combination of turnout and independents and who the independents favor. And that's the case that independents care the least about by far. So that's number one. Number two is it's too early. And it's sort of like I've likened it in other appearances to the Billy Bush tapes. If you remember the Billy Bush tapes in 2016, when those tapes came out, the Access Hollywood tapes, when they came out, they adversely affected President Trump, then candidate Trump's numbers for a short period of time, his numbers rebounded. They dropped that too early. And it's the same problem they have, I believe, with the Manhattan prosecution. So, and always keep in mind that prosecution, like all the others, is politics. It is a political prosecution. It's illegitimate. It should have never been brought. The indictment's a travesty, and it's all about politics. And since it's all about politics, it's too early. So I expect, I can't tell you what it is, but I expect something to come up and something to happen to put that case off so that if they're able to prosecute it all the way to judgment, that happens much closer to the election to maximize the impact of the result.
It is interesting to see what will happen, put mildly, who knows, but it definitely will be something to say the absolute least. And, I find the prosecution of Manhattan, and we've been over this, we both find it to be absurd, resting upon a bizarre legal theory, the most novel of novel theories, but there is the question of whether or not a jury in Manhattan would just convict Trump of anything at all, simply to do so. I think the likelihood of that is quite high, not as high as it would be in D.C., but still very high indeed. What do you think, Daniel?
No, I agree. I've said for quite some time that the case that I'm concerned about the most on Trump's behalf, the one that I think he has the most difficulty with, is the Manhattan DA's case. Although I must also say that the Manhattan DA's case is the worst of all four of these criminal prosecutions of President Trump are all horrendous. They're terrible. They're trash. But that one's the worst. And when I say it's the worst, it has the least merit of all of the four, in my opinion. But it's also the one that I think poses the greatest jeopardy for President Trump, and not ultimately. And what I mean by that is, look, I don't believe there's a conviction they could get on that Manhattan indictment that can stick. Okay. It's the appellate courts and higher courts are going to do away with it because it's just ludicrous, but it's the most likely to result in a criminal conviction, the most likely to be prosecuted to a criminal conviction. And even though the jury pool would be worse than D.C., that's a federal action that ultimately the Supreme Court has supervisory jurisdiction over. So President Trump has the least favorable court system to deal with on the New York State prosecution, or the Manhattan DA's prosecution. So that's the one I've been worried about the most. And although I have to tell you, we could talk about it, but there's about half a dozen reasons why it should have been dismissed a long time ago. And for the life of me, I can't figure out how there's even a trial to be had.
What do you think is the most compelling reason as to why it should be dismissed?
Well, the number one most compelling reason is the statutes that President Trump is charged under in New York are the falsifications of business record statutes. And there's two of them. There's the first degree and the second degree. And I've written about this on my Substack for those who want a deep dive in it. And I've covered all of what I'm about to talk about. But the most compelling reason is that both of those statutes require not just that the business record be false, and many of these are not false. We can talk about that too. But, and these are just notations, accounting notations for payments, monthly payments made to Michael Cohen. You know, legal services, some of them say legal services, some of them say retainer, and they say that's what the crime, the alleged crime is, okay? The problem is those statutes require that not only that the language or the document, it contain a false statement, an untrue statement, but it has to be made with the intent to defraud. And New York law, and I cite the cases in my Substack, require that intent to defraud is the intent to deprive someone of something of value. There has to be a deprivation of someone that the false business record entry is made for or in order to accomplish or effectuate. And they didn't even allege that in their indictment, other than in a conclusory fashion. Oh, this was done with the intent to defraud. They didn't say who was being defrauded, how they were being defrauded, and the reason that they didn't state that in the indictment is because they can't. The only potential person or entity that could have been defrauded would be the Internal Revenue Service. And the indictment itself includes the statements of fact that towards the end of the payments being made to Michael Cohen, that the president authorized a bigger payment to be made to him so he'd have something to show for it after he paid his taxes. So they weren't trying to beat the IRS out of anything. So there was just nothing done illegal. That's the most compelling reason that it shouldn't have gone anywhere.
That is fascinating. The case is, transparently political, so one should not be surprised that it being brought has nothing to do with case law or what the statute even says. But, it is what it is. Do you think that if the case is brought, that it might be that, the documents are the quote-unquote strongest aspect of Bragg's argument. Then he has the bizarre enhancement to make it a felony because the document stuff is a misdemeanor, but he has the enhancement to make it a felony because he said it was election-related, even though the state law has been interpreted to apply to state elections, not to federal elections, and the election that Bragg says Trump was engaged in shady dealings with was the 2016 presidential race. Do you think it's possible that even in New York, that's too much, even in Manhattan, to be precise, it's too much for a jury, so they would just convict Trump on misdemeanor charges, no matter how bizarrely, but because the felony enhancement is just too out of bounds, even for people who hate Trump to go along with, sort of like how they ruled that Trump did not rape E. Jean Carroll, even though the judge disgustingly, bizarrely found that Trump raped her regardless.
Yeah, well, I think based on what I've been able to follow. And let me preface my remarks here. The New York Manhattan DA's case is the most difficult case to stay abreast of. And the reason for that is that the general public can't access the court record. All right. Not easily. Okay. So these federal cases, I can sign on to PACER, which is public access to electronic records for the federal cases, and pull up anything I want. All right. And that's how I keep up with those cases. I can't do that with the New York case. I can do it to a lesser extent with the Georgia case. So in New York, if you want to get these pleadings and you want to get these rulings, you've got to actually either make a public records request or send somebody down to the courthouse. OK, so I've only gotten bits and pieces, but I do know from what I've been following is that the judge ruled on a number of what we call motions in limine. In the New York case, and this is the New York Manhattan DA's prosecution in the last 2 or 3 weeks. And from what I've read, those decisions were decidedly against President Trump and in favor of the government. And I think what the judge is going to try to do, this is my opinion, is to curtail the evidence that the jury is able to hear that might exonerate the president in order to obtain a conviction. And so, I have to tell you, it's a very, very difficult spot that the president's in there in Manhattan. But even then, at the end of the day, there's still a host of reasons why the case should have never gotten this far and shouldn't be at the point where a jury hears anything, So I don't know I have to tell you, Cotto, I've seen the estimates that that child's going to take 6 weeks to try. That if you hand it, I don't know what all they're dealing with, and you know, I don't know all the witnesses and all that stuff, but I know that I've read the indictment, and the prosecutor ought to be able to put that case on in 3 or 4 days. Literally, 3 or 4 days. How many witnesses does he need? You know, a couple of accountants, a couple of bookkeepers, Michael Cohen, a couple other unindicted co-conspirators, the guy who owns National Enquirer, and blah, blah, blah. And that case is over. They're going to drag it out for 6 weeks. So the Lord only knows what they're going to put on. I don't know how they do it. And it reminds me, but here's the thing. It's going to make it very difficult to get someone favorable to President Trump on the jury. And the reason for that is the people who would be most likely to be favorable to President Trump can't miss 6 weeks of work. You see? So I think that's what's behind that. That's my personal opinion. But I liken it to the O.J. Simpson case, if you remember that. That case should have been tried in a month, and they tried it for a year and a half, you know? And so sometimes these cases are drug out for various different reasons, and the end result in the O.J. Simpson case obviously wasn't good to the prosecution to make it that long of a case. But a six-week case is going to be tough for a business person or somebody with a job to even serve on. So I think that's going to cut against President Trump.
I agree. And by the way, if I were on the OJ jury, I would have voted to acquit. Not because I thought OJ was innocent. I certainly don't believe that, but because the prosecution did not make its case adequately. There was the infamous, if the glove does not fit, you must acquit line. And I mean, there are other things, but that sums it up. But I'm the sort of guy, if I'm on the jury, even if it's a person who I absolutely despise, I'm going to apply the strictest standard of scrutiny to the prosecution's case. So needless to say, Alvin Bragg would not want me on his jury. But anyway, just, you know, to addressing the New York case, because it is coming up, or so it seems. And Daniel, just before we get back to my monologue about Trump's immunity argument, which, of course, is being made to the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., if Trump's trial is delayed, if it does not begin on March 15th, what do you think the foremost reason would be if this pans out?
Well, there's two or three reasons why the Manhattan case may not go to trial on April 15th. Number one, there's some additional discovery that's supposed to be incoming from the United States Department of Justice any day. That's what prompted the first continuance in the first place. That could very well prompt another continuance. The second thing, we have this brewing issue over whether the judge needs to recuse himself or be recused. I would be very surprised if that doesn't come to a head before the trial. I'm sure that for the uninitiated, the judge's daughter, allegedly, I'll say, had a X account or Twitter account, and she had a picture of President Trump behind bars and had made just some absolutely inflammatory comments and tweets and posts about President Trump. And then when Laura Loomer, for those who know Laura Loomer, posted on social media about all of this, and she brought the goods. I read through all of it. They started circling the wagons over at the judge's daughter's camp and tried to claim it wasn't her account, which is just really silly. And so, you know, a community note got put on those posts and those articles. There were a couple of articles published in New York media about it. And, you know, it was really a rather transparent attempt to lie, I'll say, you know, to spread some misinformation. So that just reinforced for me that it's the judge's daughter. And I'm sure that there are people looking behind the scenes now to find out how much communication the judge has with his daughter, particularly through social media, and if he has a social media account. And that's all going to come to a head in all probability before the trial starts, and if not, shortly thereafter. So there's another reason. And then there may be, I haven't been able to verify this, but I believe that Trump's legal team, from some of the reporting that I've read, had attempted to get the Court of Appeal to weigh in on some of the issues, the dismissal issues. And I believe that a couple of those things might still be lingering with the Court of Appeal to weigh in on. And the reason I say I'm not sure is I haven't been able to pull the record and see for sure. And the problem you get there is if you send somebody down to the court, down to the clerk's office to try to get the record, well, you can't get it all. You don't want all the pleadings. You have to know what individual documents you want, which would require me to fly to Manhattan to do it myself. And I haven't had the time or the opportunity to do it. So that's a little bit up in the air, and the reporting on it is very, very scant. But the combination, any one of those three things, or maybe even something I haven't thought of, is probably going to result in the continuance of the case.
We shall definitely see what happens. One other issue that Bragg is facing, it's that Michael Cohen, who is his star witness, was found by a federal judge to possibly have engaged in perjury. This just happened a few weeks ago, perhaps by the time those people see or hear this. So it's really it's really something else that Bragg is relying upon. This man who's admitted to perjury in addition to what the judge found. It's bizarre that Bragg would rely upon this man. It speaks to the fundamental weakness of his case.
Yeah, in fact, I think I would go a little further and say that I don't believe that the law should sanction any prosecutor, state or federal prosecutor's use of a person like Michael Cohen, a convicted felon, with a person with absolutely no credibility whatsoever. There's not a scenario in which Michael Cohen could say or do anything in the presence of a jury that anyone could have any confidence was the truth. And I just don't believe that prosecutors should be able to base their case on people, any case, on people who have such a complete, utter, total lack of credibility.
So. I agree entirely. It's something else to say the absolute least. Now, finally, returning to my monologue. The absence of historical precedent for prosecuting presidents underscores the constitutional and practical challenges of such actions. The reluctance to prosecute presidents for official acts, despite past controversies, demonstrates the inherent difficulties and risks involved. Furthermore, the longstanding recognition of presidential immunity in both common law and constitutional interpretation reinforces its importance in preserving the integrity of the executive branch. Throughout American history, presidents have made controversial decisions and faced criticism for their actions. However, the tradition of refraining from criminal prosecution for official acts has remained intact. This historical precedent reflects a collective recognition of the unique challenges faced by the presidency and the need to protect it from undue interference. To depart from this long-standing practice would not only undermine the principles of executive authority, but also set a dangerous precedent for future administrations. In considering the scope of presidential immunity, the court must exercise judicial restraint and adhere to the clear statement rule. Just as Congress must expressly state its intent to subject the president to judicial review, criminal statutes should not be construed to apply to the president's official acts without clear and unambiguous language. This approach safeguards against the politicization of the judiciary and preserves the delicate balance of powers envisioned by the framers. The clear statement rule serves as a safeguard against judicial overreach and ensures that the separation of powers is respected by requiring explicit authorization from Congress for the prosecution of the president. The rule prevents courts from encroaching on the executive branch's domain and preserves the autonomy of the presidency. This principle is essential for maintaining the checks and balances that are fundamental to the American system of government. Obviously, other people will disagree. They, I presume, would want a free-for-all just so Trump can be owned, so to speak. But judging from my understanding of history, I'm not a lawyer, but I do know a thing or two about history. I've written books about history. You have my quote-unquote verdict. I really do believe that the situation is as I described it, and that makes the whole Trump has no immunity argument bizarre in my eyes. There's a bit more to get to my monologue, its conclusion, but far more interesting is Daniel's perspective on what I just said. Daniel, anything to say?
Yeah, well, listen, I think that the Supreme Court is going to agree with you, and I'll tell you that they've already given us a clear indicator that they agree with you. And let me elaborate on that. The presidential immunity issue is before the court on President Trump's motion to dismiss. Now, before I get to this, let me say, this is one of the issues that I think I need to give credit to some other people. There are some other legal commentators that I follow and that I'm friends with on social media. One of them is a criminal defense lawyer who has defended about 50 of the January 6th defendants. His name's William Shipley. He's a former federal prosecutor, and he actually is the first person to observe this or make this observation that I'm about to share with you. So on a motion to dismiss an indictment, the court ordinarily conducts a review of it using this standard review. The court reviews the motion, assuming all of the facts alleged in the indictment are true. Okay? So that's a big hurdle for a criminal defendant, because the court says, okay, we're going to look at this motion to dismiss, but we're going to assume everything the prosecutors alleged as a fact. The facts alleged, that's important in this case, because this indictment, or all of these indictments against President Trump, are laced with utter nonsense that should never be an indictment. Okay. But with respect to the facts are assumed as true. All right. William Shipley was the first person the first commentator I'm aware of who said, I don't think the court's going to review these questions, or the Supreme Court's going to review this question using that framework of assuming everything the prosecutor alleged in the indictment is true. And the first good indication we have that the Supreme Court is probably going to use a different standard of review is the writ grant itself. And let me flip over to it so I can read it. The Supreme Court asked the parties to brief the following. Whether, and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office? That's what the United States Supreme Court told the parties to brief. But think about this. For conduct, quote, for conduct alleged to involve official acts, close quote, the indictment does not allege a single time that the president was involved in any official acts. The special counsel is going to vigorously argue, and has throughout the case, that this is not a case involving official acts of the president, for the most part anyway. So that's the first tell. The only party alleging that the president's acts were official acts is President Trump's legal team. So that's an incredible tell. That is an indication to the court, says this is the question we want to answer. This is the question being posed by the defense. And I think that it's a strong indicator of how the court's going to view the issue. That's how they're going to frame it. That's how they're going to approach it. And that's a tell on what the result's going to be. Now, that's just my opinion. And once again, I'm reading tea leaves. But that's very, very clear, because the prosecutor, the special counsel, did not allege these were official acts.
It's interesting also because the Supreme Court did find that events that take place or actions that take place in the outer perimeter of the president's official behavior. These were protected from civil liability. So the question becomes, if the official acts and stuff in the outer perimeter, if these are protected from civil liability, why would it be then that criminal acts are not? This is a good for the goose, good for the gander situation. And nobody has been able to explain this to me other than to make some argument in the vein of, well, you know, it's different because basically it is shut up fascist. That's essentially what the argument here boils down to. And it's without question one of the weakest arguments I've ever heard about anything Trump may or may not have done. The idea that he should be held liable criminally for something that he cannot be held liable for civilly, when the burden of proof for a civil charge is much less than it is for a criminal charge. So obviously, if a civil charge is regarded by the court system as being less serious than a criminal charge, why would the president be immune from liability for a civil charge but not for a criminal charge? This, to me, is a very, very... It's the fundamental question here. If you're going to make the argument that Trump should be held criminally liable for his official acts or acts in their outer perimeter of his presidential duties, the Supreme Court has said that he's civilly immune. It's to say it's a weak argument is far too charitable to those who make it.
No, I agree with you completely, and I think that look at the nature of the charges that have been brought against President Trump in the D.C. indictment. You know, defrauding the United States is one of the counts. There's four counts. Two of them are obstruction of official proceedings. Those are already at the Supreme Court on a J6 defendant's challenge. And we could talk about, it's a little bit off topic on the presidential immunity issue, but the overwhelming likelihood is the Supreme Court's going to toss those charges for everybody, not just Trump, but for everybody. And there's good reasons for that, because it's poppycock to begin with. Then the other two counts. So I really think that ultimately we're only going to be talking about the Supreme Court Nixon two counts with the presidential immunity issue. One of them is defrauding the United States. That's the statute, the federal statute that's ordinarily used to prosecute tax cheats. And their claim is that the president was trying to defraud the people of the United States by overturning the election. I mean, it's just bogus. And then the other one is the interfering with people's right to vote statute, the same statute that they used against the Klan. It even talks about the statute itself makes it illegal to ride the roads in disguise. I mean, it's just ludicrous. And their argument is that President Trump, by he's trying to deprive people of their vote by overturning the election. I mean, I can't even articulate this lunacy, and it's just hideous. And to watch anybody with a law degree that went on television talking about this nonsense has got to be able to point, look, this is terrible. This is the best they could come up with. This is crap indictment. Anybody that says any different has just got their head up the rear end, in my opinion.
The big problem with the idea that Trump was trying to defraud anyone of anything is that the Supreme Court last year came out with a ruling which said that defrauding must pertain to money or property. So the question is then, how is Jack Smith able to even charge Trump with this, let alone, you know, have it go to a courtroom?
Well, good question. Because he's in D.C., and, you know, something we need to fix, I really, and hopefully if President Trump can get back in office, have a Republican House and a Republican Senate to work with, one thing we need to fix is to facilitate pretrial review of dispositive motions in criminal cases in federal court. And let me break that down in layman's terms. That it's very, the average criminal defendant in federal court has a very, very limited right. If he files a motion to dismiss a case, has a very limited right to go to the court of appeal if the district judge denies that before trial. Ordinarily, those issues get dealt with on the court by the court of appeal after trial and conviction. Okay. And that needs to be changed. That's why the former governor of Virginia got prosecuted and convicted, and then the Supreme Court threw it out unanimously. But his political career was over already. Ted Stevens, United States Senator from Alaska, same thing. His prosecution goes through, and then, you know, years later, he gets exonerated when the appeals are all over. And it was prosecutorial misconduct in his case. But we need to facilitate the pre-trial review of issues that would dispose of a case in federal criminal court. And that would end a lot of this chicanery, in my opinion.
So do you think Jack Smith brought charges that he knew would be declared unconstitutional down the road?
In my opinion, if you take anybody who looks at this, let me give you a for instance. Take the obstruction of official proceedings charge. Those two counts had never been used to charge anybody in this context. And when I say that, that includes everybody charged on January 6th. And the reason for it was that statute, which is 18 U.S.C. 1512, was passed after the Enron scandal. And during the Enron scandal, some of the bad actors, shall we say, were tampering with evidence, tampering with witnesses, and destroying evidence and getting other people to destroy evidence. And there was a gap in federal law because it was a congressional investigation that was being interfered with. And there wasn't a statute to cover that. So they couldn't charge, the feds couldn't charge a bunch of these people with crimes because they didn't have a crime to charge them with. So Congress passed this statute, and it talks about if you hide evidence, destroy evidence, tamper with evidence in a congressional investigation, or otherwise interfere with official proceedings. So anybody reading this will say, wait a minute, this doesn't have anything to do with somebody protesting an election. It doesn't have anything to do with somebody protesting about the Electoral College. And that's what the Supreme Court, mark this one down too, Street told you this, the Supreme Court's going to throw that out and say that it is an illegal use of 18 U.S.C. 1512 to charge any of these people associated with January 6th. It has no applicability to that, and they're going to dismiss those counts. And that'll be two of the counts against President Trump. So if you had that knowledge, if you knew that's what the statute was about, and no one had ever been charged in such a circumstance, no one had ever been charged under that statute outside the confines of a congressional investigation and trying to influence the evidence before a congressional investigation, then you would know that this isn't ultimately going to go anywhere. So surely Jack Smith knew it wasn't going to go anywhere, but he thinks he's, hey, I'm in D.C., and maybe I can get all this put off. And you can see how long it took. January 6th was January 6th, 2021. It was over 3 years ago. And it just, that issue on that statute just got to the Supreme Court this month. And that's what this was all about. See, because they know in most cases they can ruin people before a higher court's going to straighten everything out. And I believe that's what's going on here. Now, I don't have a source inside the special prosecutor's office or anything like that. These are all my opinions, but they're opinions based on something that's blatantly obvious to anybody with a law degree.
It's terrible what's going on. Lawfare, that's what it is in a nutshell.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it's going to end anytime soon. Either Trump wins, his opponents will still try to use the law against him and his high-profile supporters and anyone else they don't like, which is a pretty long list. This unfortunately is not going anywhere. One thing the Democrats have done is cultivate a very devoted team of lawyers to go after anyone they dislike in very expensive ways. And there's a bottomless pit of money from the Democratic side. So people, even if they have the law on their side, they're basically beaten into submission by those who use the law, they manipulate it against their political opponents. It's very sad, but that's what America has come to.
Well, look, there's no better illustration of abusing the law to attack political opponents than what has happened to Donald J. Trump. Just take E. Jean Carroll, the E. Jean Carroll case. It's the only case that I'm aware of in history. Now, I could be wrong. Maybe there's another case that I'm not familiar with where a person sued someone. And they had an entire team funding their litigation. This lady never, and look, it's not unusual for lawyers to fund litigation. I fund litigation all the time because I represent people who don't have any money. Okay. But we're talking about a person who was hooked up with a bunch of lawyers and a bunch of Democrat donors who spent millions of dollars, apparently, I mean, from what I've read, to fund her litigation, E. Jean Carroll's lawsuits against President Trump. You know, these are people that would have never, I mean, these weren't charitable contributions, you know. And then you take that, then you've got the New York legislature, because E. Jean Carroll's case was prescribed. It was, the statute of limitations had run on it. It was too long. It happened allegedly. She's not sure. It happened in 94, 95, 96. I'm not making that up. She doesn't know the year this terrible thing supposedly happened to her. But even if it did, it was too late. It was, the case was over with. She couldn't bring it because the statute of limitations run. So the legislature in New York passes a special statute in 2022 to give her another year, not just her, but other people in similar circumstances had another year to bring their lawsuits. So her claim got revived by a Democrat-controlled legislature in the state of New York so that the suit could be brought in the first place. I mean, can you fathom a more politically oriented, motivated bunch of legal garbage than what I've just described? I mean, I can't. If there's, well, you might could pick the DA, the DA's prosecution in Georgia might be worse, but maybe that's the only one that gets any worse. You know, so what the Democrats have done, and I got another illustration of this I'm giving to people, and I don't know what happened with it. I'll need to look. There was a bill passed, you know, the Democrats have a bare majority in Virginia in the state house and state senate, and they passed a bill to revoke the charitable status of the United Daughters of the Confederacy. Now, that bill had to be signed by the governor, and I don't know if he vetoed it or not. I haven't checked. I need to go back and check. But who would do something like that? I mean, this is the new Democrat Party. It is just absolute warfare using the law in every conceivable way to attack anybody you don't agree with. The United Daughters of the Confederacy, I mean, these are people, these are mostly elderly ladies. There's some young women as well, but they just try to raise money to support cemeteries for Confederate veterans and things like that. I mean, it's just unfathomable. This is not your grandparents' Democrat Party. This is a militant, revolutionary, radical group of people who are going to abuse the law in every conceivable way possible. And they proved it at every turn for the last 2.5 years.
They really have their greatest success, quote unquote success, at the state level, obviously. And that's, you know, as Felix Frankfurter said, states are the laboratories of democracy. And we're certainly seeing how they are the laboratories of post-democracy in this context. And I fear it will only get worse, because even if, you know, Trump is reelected, there's Republican House and Senate, which may well happen, these states are still going to do what they're going to do. So when I said before that the lawfare isn't going to stop, I meant it. Even Democratic counties and Republican states, look what happened to the McCloskeys in St. Louis, which is functions as a city and a county. So it's really a sad, scary state of affairs, to say the absolute least. One question before I do the conclusion to my monologue, Daniel, then we unfortunately wrap things up. Do you think that at this point, Alvin Bragg and Fannie Willis, and I guess I could throw in Jack Smith as well, do you think they really care whether or not what they're doing makes Trump more or less electable? Because they don't want him to be elected. Certainly, this is not the way to do it. The way to do it would have been through civil prosecutions that are always designed to destroy someone's reputation and cost them a hell of a lot of money. That's just the way to do it. If you criminally prosecute someone on thin charges, you turn them into a political martyr if they are a politician, and that's clearly what's happening with Trump. So do you think at this point, even if they thought at the beginning this stuff would sandbag Trump's candidacy, do you think Willis, Smith, and brag care whether or not what they're doing actually makes it more or less likely that Trump gets elected in November? Or you think they're beyond that? This is personal now. What do you think is going on there? Because that, to me, is a profoundly fascinating question.
Yeah, I think originally the intent was to undermine the ability of President Trump to get the GOP nomination and run for president. Clearly, and I know early on, you know, we had some Never Trumpers who were claiming, oh, they're doing all this to try to get Trump to be the nominee. No, they weren't, because they wouldn't have filed lawsuits in all 50 states trying to disqualify President Trump from the ballot under the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment if they wanted him to run. Okay, so that effort, to behind which an enormous amount of effort was put, an enormous amount of resources that the Supreme Court just killed with their recent decision, belies any contention that the Democrats didn't want or that they wanted President Trump to be the nominee. So I think initially, in my opinion, the effort behind or the reason behind all of this effort was to stop Donald Trump from being the nominee. Polling and what we really know, you can look at how many more votes Donald Trump got in 2020 versus 2016 to see how strong he is. The states that he won, the states that Biden won, and I put in air quotes there, you know, the Rust Belt states and the swing states that Biden eked out or squeaked out or cheated out a victory, so to speak. So they know, the Democrats know President Trump is probably the most difficult person for them to beat. So I think that's what all this was about. At this stage, I believe that they know that's not going to work, but they're too invested to do anything else. The real question, so for instance, if the Manhattan case, because that looks like the only case that's actually got a realistic probability of going to trial before November, the real question is, if the case goes to trial and the Manhattan DA gets a conviction of President Trump, are they going to be able to put him in prison between now and November? That's the real question. And then, if so, what happens then? And I don't have the answer to those questions, but I can tell you that there are a lot of people who are not going to stand for it. So I think that a lot of this is being done because, and this is just my opinion, this is my theory, The Democrats on they pretend, the Democrats in the media spread a bunch of propaganda and misinformation about January 6th, and they act like and pretend like it was way worse than it actually was. It was really just a riot, and they act like it's an insurrection. No, it's not. I've got a whole chapter in one of my books. It's not an insurrection, and all of that. I think as a corollary to all of what we've been talking about, they actually, or at least some of them, actually want to foment an actual rebellion. They want people to be up in arms and say, we're not going to take it anymore. And if they can cuff President Trump and try to take him to Rikers Island prison bars, they think they can get it. And maybe they'll be right.
I think that I'm sure that I have no doubt that's what a lot of them want. Practically, though, the Secret Service has operational authority over any building the president's in, which would basically make it impossible for him to go to a conventional jail. I think that what they would do if he were convicted is try to sentence him to home detention, give him the maximum fine, and drag this out in a way that they think is as embarrassing for him as possible, even if they know that it won't make him lose it, make him more likely to win because of the rage vote. It would be gratifying to their base, and one must remember that Merchan and Bragg are elected officials in an overwhelmingly Democratic area. So I would say at that point, they would just be concerned with getting a conviction on the record that they could use to ward off any challengers in an upcoming primary.
Well, I agree with you. You know, and you raised an interesting point, and your audience needs to hear this elaborated on. Yeah, the president is protected by federal law, by the Secret Service. And so even if President Trump, keep this in mind, if they try to lock up President Trump, they've got to bring a Secret Service detail with him. You know, so I don't know really what the end game is here. But I will say this. I wouldn't want to be one of those secrets on that Secret Service detail.
It's these are absolutely crazy times. It's highly unfortunate that things have come to this. I even if he doesn't get any, and I don't think he will get any jail time, it's also conceivable that he would for the New York thing. The Democrats there would still try to make this as bad as possible for him, even though it would backfire politically. But they would do this to enhance their own careers, because they would be heroes in a primary where, you know, people hate Trump. And so them going after Trump is just, you know, a goldmine of support. It's a very cynical, opportunistic ploy, but these are hard-nosed urban politicians we're dealing with. So it's no, it's you know, I think that this is clear enough to see. But anyway, now in conclusion, I believe firmly that the Supreme Court must affirm the principle of presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for official acts. To do otherwise would jeopardize the independence of the presidency and undermine the constitutional framework of the United States government. By upholding presidential immunity, the court protects the integrity of executive power and ensures that future presidents can fulfill their duties without fear of politically motivated reprisals. The dismissal of President Trump's indictment is not only consistent with historical precedent, but also essential for the preservation of the nation's democratic institutions. It reaffirms the principle that the presidency is a sacred trust entrusted with the solemn duty of serving the American people and upholding the Constitution. As guardians of the rule of law, the Supreme Court must uphold the principles of executive authority and preserve the integrity of the presidency for generations to come. All of that, everything I've read in my monologue, is my foremost opinion. Whether or not people agree or disagree with it is their prerogative, but that is where I am coming from. Daniel, anything to say as we unfortunately wind things down tonight?
Yeah, well, I tell you, you and I agree quite often, you know, and I've appeared on the show several times. We also disagree from time to time, but you and I are of like mind on this issue. I think that this is one of the most critical decisions that the Supreme Court has made in my lifetime, the presidential immunity question, because this, the D.C. indictment in particular, look, all of the indictments of President Trump are reprehensible, I mean, inappropriate travesties, in my opinion. But the D.C. one in particular is an absolute abuse of federal law. It's an abuse of the federal police power. It is an unprecedented attack on the presidency, on the office of the presidency, and in my view, on our republic. And the United States Supreme Court is our last, they're the last bastion of freedom. They're the last people, the last group standing between the presidency, this republic, and the current Department of Justice. And if there's just, to me, there can't be any other result, not if the presidency is going to move forward in this country with having the efficacy that it had in the past. That's how critical this is. I believe it's a national security issue. I believe it's a future of the country issue. It's something that threatens the republic, and the Supreme Court needs to stop it.
I think the Supreme Court will make a lot of people very aggravated with its decision. I don't think I'll be one of them, but it will be interesting to see how it goes. It's inconceivable to me that it would essentially overturn the spirit of the previous ruling, which deals with civil immunity. No need to wade back into that matter. But I think that it's pretty obvious that the law is on Trump's side with regard to the claims that he makes before the Supreme Court. And, you know, this case would, if it goes his way, it would affect everything except for the New York case. So it's, you know, it definitely is a major, major deal, to say the absolute least. Daniel, I suppose, but before we go, looking at the politics of this, you are from Louisiana. Louisiana was, even within my lifetime, a very Democratic state. It's sort of strange because it's not like other Southern states. The Southern quadrant, third would probably be a better way of putting it, of it, is a lot like New Jersey meets the Caribbean. And if anybody knows the area, then they know what I mean. And it sort of mirrored, as a matter of fact, the white ethnic and black Northeast in its politics pretty heavily. You're very loyal to the Democratic Party, especially on economic issues. There was a sort of ethnic social conservatism as well. Then, of course, you had the difference was that in the northern part of the state, there was much more of an Anglo-Protestant presence, which fueled the rise of the GOP and eventually made it down to South Louisiana. But what did not happen up in places like New Jersey is a similar political transformation. They only grow more Democratic. But anyway, there are still quite a few Democrats around in Louisiana. Many, many, many former Democrats. I think arguably at this point, most Republicans in Louisiana are former Democrats. So what is the impression you get about the turn of the Democratic Party with regard to lawfare and how it's treating its opponents generally? How do you see people reacting to this in your not terribly long ago, very Democratic area?
Yeah, the vast majority of people in Louisiana view what's going on, the prosecutions of the president, the same way I do. And I will tell you that you're exactly right that the state of Louisiana has gone through a transformation. In 1989, when I registered to vote, when I turned 18, I registered as a Republican. So a white male registering to vote as a Republican was out of the ordinary in Louisiana in 1989. We were well represented by then, but not the majority. And that's changed completely in my lifetime, you know, in the last 35 years, I guess it is. I was kind of scary to say that. It's been 35 years since I got out of high school. But what underpins conservatism in Louisiana is more than anything is religion. Okay. And of course, today is the holiest day on the Christian calendar, which is Easter, where we celebrate the resurrection of Christ. And so the Democrats have gotten farther and farther and farther and farther away. And as you and I talked about today, the president declaring today a day of transgender visibility and prohibiting anything religious at the Easter day, at the Easter egg hunt. And it was just unbelievable. And that's not the only reason that people have left the Democratic Party in Louisiana, but that's the primary reason. And I can tell you the vast majority of people in Louisiana, their confidence in our institutions, in the federal government, in the United States Department of Justice, in the federal courts have been undermined by what the Democrats have done.
Yeah, Louisiana is a fascinating place to look into the politics of, not only because it's such a rich political history, for better and for worse, especially when it comes to public corruption, but it's fascinating because it's not like understanding the history of a state like Arkansas or Alabama or Georgia. Louisiana has a unique ethnic dynamic and racial dynamic that makes it more similar to what you'd expect in the Northeast than in the South. So I'm always fascinated by the politics there. And it is something else. Now, of course, Louisiana is more religious than the Northeast, but once upon a time, they were about equal. That was, you know, a very different time in America. But and even the people in Louisiana who are not, as I understand it, Dan can correct me if I'm wrong, but even the people in Louisiana who are irreligious, and of course, that's growing there as it's growing in other places, just not as much, but they tend to have a more socially conservative value set that is rooted in the area's interesting social conservatism, because people from Louisiana I've met tend to be very tolerant of others, yet very conservative with their own behavior and moral beliefs. But at the same time, they like to have a good time and they don't like to force their views upon their neighbor. It's a very unique form of social conservatism that you certainly would not find in the backwoods of Alabama or unless you're down by the Gulf, then it is very similar to Louisiana. I need to correct that. Alabama or Mississippi, the same thing, but as you go farther up, it's different. The situation in Louisiana is fascinating.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of a friend of mine who's a liberal Democrat. And I think this kind of encapsulates the, incongruence of political liberalism in Louisiana. She asked me one time, she said, "Do you know the difference between a liberal in Louisiana and a liberal from up north?" And I'm like, "No, I don't know what it is." She says, "And the liberals in Louisiana own handguns too." So It's this kind of strange dichotomy that we have where people, the conservatives may be not so conservative on some social things like drinking. You know, there's a tremendous drinking culture in Louisiana, even at a young age. When I was coming up, it was legal for me to possess alcohol when I was 17 in Ouachita Parish, the parish I live in. And I could purchase alcohol when I was 18. You know, so, and this was, it was an incredibly religious state back then, you know. So we have this on both sides, both on the conservative and the liberal side of what you would classically characterize people as in Louisiana, still have these incongruent beliefs and belief systems.
It is something else. It really is. We're about to go over time, but it's okay. We're wrapping up anyhow, but it's just a fascinating conversation. In my county here in Florida, where I was born and mostly raised, it used to be a dry county on the weekends. Then it went to Sunday, and now it's not a dry county at all. So you can see how the times have changed, and certainly it's become much more secular since I was a boy, tremendously so, but it still has a very sort of Anglo and Scots-Irish Protestant settler culture that came about in the late 1800s. So Louisiana obviously has a much older culture, but it's interesting that the people who settle a place definitely give it a unique set of values. And those do not necessarily wash away as quickly as some people would expect, particularly if there's not wide-scale immigration to the area. My region did not see wide-scale immigration in a big way until basically the 90s, but really the 2000s. And since the late 2010s, it's been a rocket to the moon. It's something. And the politics of Louisiana, to me, are fascinating because they are a lens onto the politics of other places, even though Louisiana is so unique that some things there are you're only going to find there. For better or for worse, one could say the same about anywhere. I could tell you a lot of interesting things about Florida that might make some people not want to move here, but that's another story for another time. But Daniel, thank you very much for stopping by tonight. It's been an outstanding conversation. I hope you got as much out of it as I did.
I did, and thank you for having me. And if I could, one parting shot, I would like your audience to know at my Substack, I wrote about the federal indictment. I've written about all the indictments, but I wrote about the federal indictment of President Trump. People need to read that. It's a good background, and you'll know, if you didn't know how bogus this was, you'll know for sure after you read it.
So. And would you tell them your Substack web address before we go?
Yeah, sure. The best way to get it is just to go to my website, which is danielrstreet.com. There's links at my website to my social media. There's links to all my books. You can get all my books. There's links to my Substack. And by the way, the Substack's free, won't cost you a thing. And there's a link at my website to my most recent book where you can get the digital version, the Kindle version, or the audiobook for free.
Got it. And everyone, thank you for tuning in. I hope you found this conversation to be as enlightening as Daniel and I did. Please stay safe, be well, and cheers.